Washington. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Shairana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
By lonely border walls, I heard a young girl calling, Daddy, they have taken you away. Now they run us from our land, chasing with an iron hand. Now amongst the lifeless bodies you lay, Lord, Palestine, where once they watched the small free birds fly. Their love was on the wing, they had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Palestine. Lonely border wall, I heard a young man calling. Nothing matters, mama, when you're free. Against the Zionists and the Kremlin, I threw stones, they ran me down. Now you must carry on with dignity. Low lie the fields of Palestine, where once they watched the small free birds fly. Their love was on the wing, they had dreams to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Palestine. By lonely bomb shelter, she watched her last child falling. Oh, she'll wait and hope and pray that she'll live to see the day. She can grieve in peace in her dear Palestine. Low lie the fields of Palestine, where once they watched the small free birds fly. Their love was on the wings, they had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Palestine. It's so lonely round the fields of Palestine.
So lonely in the fields of Palestine. Welcome, everybody. This is Zain Al-Amin, your host for the Shayanana Show. And today's topic is, of course, again, about Gaza and about one of the greatest crimes committed by U.S. government in the 21st century, maybe even in the also in the 20th century. And the main perpetrator here is Biden. And I know you liberals that are calling, are doing the scaremongering right now about Trump. We're not responsible for Trump. We're not. You are responsible for Trump. Biden is responsible for Trump. He's willing to waste away. He talks about, I'm sure you're getting texts right now saying, oh, democracy's at risk. You know, Trump is going to be voted in. That's baloney. That's baloney. Already Biden risked our democracy. We told him, stop killing Palestinians. We told him, stop killing Palestinians and we'll vote for you. That's what the Arab community told him. That's what the Jewish anti-Zionist community told him. That's what the liberation theology Catholics have told him. His own religion, his own sect told him. But no. No, he continues to kill, continues to starve. Yes, yes, yeah. I am saying he continues, not Netanyahu. He continues. He can stop this with one phone call. And I want to remind you about something. When Begin was massacring Lebanese and Palestinians in 1982, Reagan gave him a call and told him, listen, you got to stop this nonsense. And he stopped it. He stopped the massacre by Israelis of Lebanese and Palestinians. And Begin said there was this senator that disagreed with Reagan. You know, you talk about Republicans and Democrats. Oh my God, if you still believe that baloney, oh my God, God help us. But he told him, you know, he said that the senator told me that he would have gone on, he would have continued massacring people. And you know who that senator was? That was Biden. Biden was to the right of Reagan on that. Reagan, who we curse all the time, was better about Palestine than not only Biden, but Obama. And Obama's responsible for bringing us this geriatric, glitching president that we have right now. This is, you know, How many millions are eligible to be president? And this is the choice we get between Biden and Trump? Come on, people. Come on. So here's what Michigan did. They said, okay, we're going to vote uncommitted and make a statement. And hopefully we'll get like 9,000 voters in Michigan, you know, this swing state. And maybe we'll get you know, later they said, maybe we'll get, you know, 10, 20,000 people to vote uncommitted. And guess what? 150,000 voted uncommitted. And it's going to grow. It's going to grow. You know why? Because Biden and Kamala Harris are playing this game because they got so scared of this uncommitted vote, so frightened that they actually did an airdrop of food with Jordan. First of all, Jordan was already doing airdrops of food in Gaza. Because why? Because they're actually delivering food on land, by land, to the Israelis that are killing Palestinians. This is quintessential performative work, by Jordan. The king of Jordan is a scum, I can't even tell you what I think about him because I'm not allowed to on radio. But he is scum. He's a hypocrite. He's a liar. He doesn't give a damn about the Palestinians. So anyway, Biden, he does this airdrop of a few hundred meals for a population, you know, of millions, and says, okay, yeah, we're doing something. You know why he did that? He did that because he got scared of this uncommitted vote to show that he's doing something. And Kamala Harris shows up also. This was part of their plan. She shows up and says, we're calling for a ceasefire, and people cheer. And then she says, for 6 weeks. Meaning, in essence, You know, because these people are racist. I don't care how many ethnicities Kamala Harris carries. She's married to a Zionist. She's a criminal. People like that would be going taken to The Hague. That's the reality right now. So what do? They drop these and they say, "Oh, we're helping." They could easily say, "Listen, people, we are going to open up the land, so to allow delivery by land." There's hundreds of trucks waiting by the side, waiting on each side of Palestine right now, of the occupied territories, waiting to be. They could just let those in. Instead, they insult us with this drop. They insult the people of Gaza. The people of Gaza even were declaring that this was an insult, this was a humiliation, this was a taunt by the American administration. Having said that, I'm going to tell you what the news is right now. The news is, one is that first I want to send my condolences to the family of Aaron Bushnell, who set himself on fire in protest of this travesty that Biden is committing. And Biden didn't say a damn thing about that. He didn't say a damn thing. He always talks about supporting the troops, and he didn't say a damn thing because he knows that he was addressing him. Right now, what happened is there was a huge demonstration that happened at the Israeli embassy last weekend, where they besieged the embassy. Right now, there's an encampment, and there are more Palestinian flags and Israeli flags all around the Israeli embassy. We have besieged the Israeli embassy, and we will continue to besiege it because there's a 24-hour encampment right now there to support so that the flags can stay up, so the Palestinian flags, so our presence can stay there legally. And the media copped out on this one, totally copped out on this one. They described him as a disturbed person and all of that. He's the most insane person. You know what's disturbed? You know what's disturbed is a president who kills 13,000 children and eats ice cream when talking about genocide. That is disturbed. Biden is a very disturbed, a mentally disturbed man, not fit for humanity. He is not human. He's a monster. You understand this? He's a monster. And if you don't understand that, then you're a racist. Deal with it. Deal with your racism. If you vote for Biden, you're a racist because what you're saying is that it's okay to kill 13,000 children, let alone 30,000 people, men and women and children. You're saying that's okay. Biden, get this through your heads. Biden is our Hitler, and I'm addressing liberals because masses of Americans, the majority of Americans are for a ceasefire. But these weaselly liberals, and some of you are listening to me right now, are still talking about electing Biden. It's disgusting. You people are disgusting. You're depraved if you vote for Biden. And we are going to start a DMV campaign here in the district in Virginia and in Maryland of uncommitted. In every state he's going to go to, there's going to be uncommitted. Every speech he's going to make, we're going to be there to interrupt him. This Thursday, tomorrow, there's going to be interruptions at every turn of the State of the Union address. Because you know why? I don't know how he's going to spin it, but let me guess. He's going to say, and you can start a drinking game about this. Let me guess. He's going to say, "Hey, terrorists." He's going to keep on saying the word terrorist to cover for the fact that he supplied weaponry 100 times since the beginning of this massacre. 100 times since the beginning of this massacre. Okay? And every time he says, "Terrace, I want you to take a drink because you're going to be wasted in the first 5 minutes, I guarantee you." But we are going to interrupt him at his speech. We're going to interrupt his caravan. We're going to interrupt every party. We're going to make these Democrats feel like doo-doo, okay? We're going to make your lives miserable. We're going to interrupt every city council a hearing on this. My own city council member in Ward 1 is a Zionist that worked for AIPAC. This is the kind of people that are running the show. He's going to be, there is no rest for the wicked, simply that. There is going to be no rest for the wicked. When this thing ends, we're going to continue dogging these people that are, whether it's the Prime Minister of England or whether it's the Prime Minister of Australia or whoever it is, in terms where whether it's Trudeau in Canada, everybody's going to be dogged until they get out of the way. There's a world of change happening right now. And there's, despite the horror, there's a lot, hell of a lot of hope, because so many people are watching these IDF posted soldiers bragging about running over Palestinians, soldiers bragging about destroying homes, destroying universities, killing doctors, killing babies. They're actually bragging about killing babies. How much does America have to listen before they say, "Wow, we've created a killing machine and we can't control it," right? We've created a killing machine and we can't control it. And the thing about it is, it's the most cowardly and immoral army and military in the world right now. The IDF is. And everybody knows this. Everybody knows this now. If they didn't know it before, everybody knows it. What they're good at is bragging about blowing up universities, killing civilians, but they're getting their behind handed to them when they're confronting Hamas, when they're confronting Hezbollah. There's so many armored vehicles right now in Israel that have been destroyed that they're having to revert back to the 60s, to these armored tanks that were made back in the 60s to bring them in. And they're not saying a single thing about the thousands of casualties among the IDF, about the hundreds of tanks and armored vehicles that have been blown to smithereens by the Palestinian resistance. And long live the resistance, long live the martyrs, long live the Lebanese resistance. And I'll tell you what, what's going to happen? The Israelis know, first of all, at the time of the Super Bowl, the Israelis know the whole game of bread and circus. They know the whole game of bread and circus. And you know what they did? They attacked Gaza during the Super Bowl while people are distracted, all the while placing an ad in there talking about Palestinians as terrorists, right? You know what's the next big circus? It's going to be the Academy Awards. And while billions are watching the Academy Awards, they plan on attacking Rafah. And Rafah, for those of you who don't know, is the southern end of Gaza, where now over a million people, over a million Palestinian civilians are crammed, and they're going to attack them during the Academy Awards. And that's why there are a mobilization among actors that are going to be turning attention away from the Academy Awards to what is the slaughter that continues. This moment in history is going to be looked at, what we're going to see is this senile president licking ice cream while talking about the killing of children, while talking about genocide. That's going to be the legacy of Genocide Joe. Everybody's going to remember him only as Genocide Joe. Every single thing that he promised during the campaign for president, he has betrayed. Not only has he betrayed, but he's outdone Trump. And now, not only did he not follow the promises, for example, on immigration, but he's calling on his buddy Trump, right? He complains about Trump, but last week, for those of you in the know that he said that he's willing to work with Trump on securing the border. It's really incredible. How dumb can American citizenry be, right, to get to a point where they will think this is a lesser evil? And fortunately, they're not that dumb. They are just realizing right now that their representatives don't represent them. We have a senator from Tennessee that is dogged by one of his constituents about Gaza and about the murder of children and women, and he says, kill them all with no consequences, no consequences, right? There's going to be accounts to be settled after this. It's not going to be pretty. There's going to be accounts settled after this. And I tell you, I will dedicate the rest of my life, and people are now already dedicating the rest of their life to overthrowing this empire, to kicking out every boot, every jackboot that's right now on Arab land out of there. We are tired of you massacring us. We are sick of it. We are sick of it, and we're angry as hell, and you can't kill our rage, because our rage is going to set you on fire, just like Bushnell set himself on fire in protest. You're going to be set on fire in the most brutal way. And that's not going to be a physical fire. It's going to be a fire that'll make you squirm and make you squirrel and hide away and go back under the rock which you came out from. That's what we're going to do. We're all renewing our dedication for resistance. And Palestine has become the litmus test for global justice. Believe me, Palestine is not just going to set the issue of Palestine as people raise it. People of all colors raise it. Mm. People from the whole of the global South raise it. Is the litmus test for global justice. And it's going to free the world, because we're seeing how it connects domestically. We're seeing free healthcare given to the monsters that are now slaughtering innocent women and children and bragging about them on Telegram. That's who gets the free healthcare. We don't. And we subsidize their healthcare, and we still don't have healthcare. We subsidize their education, and we don't have Biden has a hard time bypassing Congress when it comes to our issues, right? When it comes to healthcare, when it comes to student loan forgiveness. Oh, it's a very difficult and complicated issue. But when it comes to sending 2,000-pound bombs to Gaza, to Israel, to bomb Gaza, no problem. He will bypass. He will bypass Congress. Beyond that, I wanted to have a couple of have one piece of good news. Canada has reinstated their UNRWA funding, which is a great thing. Canada has of course, it's because of pressure, and it's because people are watching infants dying of hunger. You know, when you're starving, you can't breastfeed your child. For those of you who don't have children, you can't breastfeed your child. And imagine a mother just holding her baby as the baby withers away, and there's nothing she can do about it. Children are eating animal feed, right? And so these images that are all over the world are shaming the vampires like Trudeau, who pretend to be progressive, but are actually implicated in this genocide that's going on. And we're never going to forgive that. I don't care what Trudeau does afterwards. We're going to chase Trudeau till the end of the world. Canadians, progressive Canadians, have discovered what he's about, and they're going to pursue him, and they're going to follow him, and they're going to point to the corporate position that he's going to take after that, because that's how corporate Canada is going to reward him, and they're going to expose him at that point. The other thing is that the last thing is, I already mentioned that there's going to be a campaign of uncommitted, because it seemed to have scared them into dropping the symbolic food, along with bombs, the U.S. made bombs that have been given to Israel. I want to say something about the recording that's coming up. And this is the New York Times writer that has been exposed as an IDF intelligence officer. And this is, this is lie, the nth lie, God, the thousand lie that Israel has told. Everybody knows that they're compulsive liars. I've talked with people that are retired special ops people that say, when I was working for the Pentagon, we never believed anything the Israelis did, but we were told to obey. We were told to obey, but they are the biggest liars. Israelis, not just the Israeli government. No, not the Israeli. The vast majority of Israelis are liars, are murderers, and are calling for blood right now, for more blood. That's what's happening. Yeah, they are, the younger generation is worse than the older generation. The older generation is actually merciful. And you know who's most merciful? Are the people who actually survived the Holocaust. Those are the ones that are, when they say never again, mean never again. It's the great-grandchildren of these people that are murderers, liars, and savages. They're the most depraved people on earth, period. So let's listen to one of these depraved people, a report about them, about how this IDF intelligence officer was exposed in trying to write this piece for the New York Times.
Crystal, what are you taking a look at?
A massive scandal is developing at the New York Times, where it has now been revealed that the co-author of a discredited article on rape on October 7th liked genocidal posts on social media, is a former member of an IDF intelligence unit, and had not even worked as a journalist at all prior to taking on a central role in Times coverage. The Times is now investigating the journalist, a woman by the name of Anat Schwartz. But the questions about this incident go so far beyond this one journalist and her appreciation for psychopathic social media posts. So here is the backstory. On December 28th, the New York Times published and news alerted what appeared to be an extensive investigation into one of the most fraught and contested parts of the Israeli October 7th narrative, that sexual assault was used by Hamas systematically as a weapon of war on that day. The piece was headlined, "Screams Without Words, How Hamas Weaponized Sexual Violence on October 7th," and the byline named three different authors, Jeffrey Gettleman, Anat Schwartz, and Adam Sella. Now, the fact that Hamas committed atrocities on October 7th is not in dispute. However, certain particularly horrifying anecdotes claimed by the Israeli government have fallen apart under scrutiny by Israeli outlet Haaretz. These debunked claims include that 40 babies were beheaded, that a baby was found in an oven, and that a pregnant woman had her baby cut out of her, among others. It is no accident, of course, that these stories were propagated. This agitprop about the barbarism of Hamas was crucial for Israel in their attempt to justify a barbaric assault on the Gaza Strip. So this piece, Screams Without Words, was published by the New York Times purporting to back up Israeli assertions about widespread rape on October 7th. It was incredibly significant But no sooner had the piece been published that major problems emerged. The family of a woman murdered by Hamas, who was presented as a central figure in the New York Times narrative about widespread rape, denounced the story in furious and unequivocal terms. They claimed that when the Times interviewed them about their murdered loved one, Gal Abdush, under false pretenses, the family said that they had no indication Gal had been raped, no evidence to support such claims, did not believe them to be true, and that they had no idea that the Times had planned to say that Gal had been raped. Multiple family members told the Israeli press that the media invented the story and demanded that they stop spreading lies. Gal's story comprised no less than one third of the lengthy Times report. And that was really just the beginning of the problems with that report. Key witnesses were caught telling inconsistent stories to different news outlets. Screams Without Words had relied on the testimony of a volunteer with an ultra-Orthodox nonprofit called Zaka that had been caught fabricating some of the most visceral debunked anecdotes about October 7th, including that one about the 40 beheaded babies. And the Times itself, well, they appeared to lose confidence in the reporting. As our colleague Ryan Grimm, along with Daniel Bogoslaw, reported for The Intercept, an episode of the New York Times flagship podcast, The Daily, had been planned to detail the reporting from the sexual assault piece, which had originally been much hyped by the New York Times newsroom. But as the quote-unquote reporting in the piece fell apart, the Times was left with a major dilemma about what to do. Should they ignore the problems, stand by their shoddy reporting, and push out the Daily episode as recorded? Should they edit the Daily episode and attempt to correct the record, add caveats, and effectively admit the problems with that original report? Or should they take the coward's way out and just shelve the episode entirely? Now, a responsible outlet would either correct the original story or retract it, given the serious journalistic failings that have been brought to light. But the Times chose to keep their propaganda piece as is, shelve the Daily episode, and hope that everyone just moved on. Incredibly, the lead author of that piece, Jeffrey Gettleman, was at great pains to explain that as a journalist, he did not see his job as providing evidence for his reporting claims. Take a listen.
I don't want to even use the word evidence because evidence is almost like a legal term that suggests you're trying to prove an allegation or prove a case in court. That's not my role. We all have our roles, and my role is to document, is to present information, is to give people a voice.
So if this investigation didn't include evidence, what the hell are we doing here? But as if all of that wasn't wild enough, we are now learning some absolutely shocking things about the background of the second reporter on that piece, the aforementioned Anat Schwartz. Shout out to Z Squirrel for doing this digging online. First of all, on October 7th, Anat liked to post calling for Gaza to be turned into a slaughterhouse. This post was so overtly genocidal in its rhetoric that it was actually cited in South Africa's filing at The Hague. The post read in part, "One principle that needs to be abandoned today, proportionality. Need a disproportionate response. May Israel see what she is hiding in the basement. If all the captives are not returned immediately, turn the strip into a slaughterhouse. If a hair falls from their head, execute security prisoners, violate any norm on the way to victory." The post goes on to explain, quote, "those in front of us are human animals." Anat also apparently liked a post about that 40 beheaded babies lie and another one calling for an effective propaganda operation to equate Hamas with ISIS. Love for our journalists to be out here explicitly advocating for propaganda campaigns. This is completely insane. If a journalist had liked similarly genocidal post calling for Israel to be turned into a slaughterhouse, it would be a national scandal. The entire New York Times leadership would be dragged in front of congressional hearings and summarily fired. In fact, New York Times forced out a prominent staff writer who was not involved in Israel-Palestine coverage simply for signing a letter opposing Israel's genocide in Gaza. The International Court of Justice, of course, has now agreed that it is in fact plausible Israel is committing genocide. Now, after Anat's posts were exposed, she locked down her Twitter account, deleted most of her history before returning. But while she can delete her social media history, she can't really so easily delete her professional past, which, if anything, is actually even wilder. So apparently, prior to landing this plum gig at the New York Times, Anat Schwartz had never worked as a journalist, never published a single piece anywhere ever before being scooped up by the Times in November, just after the October 7th attack. She had been working as a small-time filmmaker. Perhaps the Times was looking for someone with a flair for the cinematic. But really think about this. Actual journalists spend their entire careers dreaming of a New York Times byline. The Times, after all, is the holy grail of elite journalism. And this lady, with literally zero experience somehow gets brought in on a highly sensitive investigation on one of the most fraught topics imaginable. How the hell did this happen? But Anat is not only a former filmmaker, she is also a former IDF soldier who served, I kid you not, in an Air Force intelligence unit. So the lady with the genocidal social media posts, with no prior journalism experience and a background in Israeli military intelligence, was contracted to report on a piece which perfectly served Israeli government propaganda efforts at the time. What is happening here? Ryan, of course, has been doing great reporting as usual. He has got it from several sources. The Times is parting ways with Anat. It's already been reported she is under investigation. But at this point, those actions seem like convenient scapegoating to cover up much graver questions. Who brought this lady in? How did they find her? Who greenlit this piece? Why have they not addressed the journalistic collapse of their supposedly blockbuster investigation? And what other Israeli propaganda and lies are they currently laundering? It's not only the New York Times, by the way. Wall Street Journal recently published a piece based on zero evidence that ran cover for Israeli claims about UNRWA, which helped justify the U.S. pulling aid at a time when Palestinians in Gaza are starving to death. That piece, too, was co-authored by a so-called journalist named Carrie Keller Lynn with undeniable biases. She, too, served in the IDF and in an interview bragged about how her very close friend literally created social media for the IDF. Those are her words, not mine. Once these photos that you can see on your screen started circulating, Carrie Keller Lynn also locked her accounts, scrubbed her history to prevent anyone from gathering further insights into her pro-Israel bias. Now, this incident casts in a whole new light. The studies would show systematic bias across major news outlets when it comes to coverage of Israelis and coverage of Palestinians. Israelis are slaughtered, Palestinians just mysteriously die. Great pains are often taken to make sure that Israel is never directly ascribed blame. And as the Palestinian death toll has climbed, the coverage of their deaths has actually plummeted. It is a testament to the outrageous nature of the suffering that in spite of this onslaught of lies and propaganda, the American people still overwhelmingly support a ceasefire. Even Anat, with her skills as a filmmaker, with an Israeli intelligence background, can't craft propaganda strong enough to overcome the visceral horror of what has been done. And Sagar, Ryan has another—
Hey guys, if you want to see what I had to say to Crystal's monologue, not just this one, all of them going back to the very beginning.
So that was a report about the reporter that was hired. This is the kind of reporting the New York Times— The New York Times is done for, by the way. It's not going to close or anything, but its readership is going to drop dramatically. There's been too many scandals, and it's obvious. Even their own staff is rebelling against the editorial board. I wanted to recommend listen to Electronic Intifada, to their updates, which they do every Wednesday. I would play them, but they're happen at the same time as the show or as the same day as the show. The other thing I would encourage you to follow an ex-military guy, U.S. military person that was part of special ops, a brilliant man by the name of Greg Stoker, and his reporting on what's happening. This is somebody that knows the history, that puts things in context, that also, for example, pointed out, for example, like this association of Hamas with ISIS that the Biden administration and the Israel is trying to do is actually an accusation that's actually a confession, because he talks about when he did his tours in the Middle East, he discovered that what's happening is that there is actually an engagement with ISIS, because they were so caught up with regime change that they actually supported ISIS and Al-Qaeda in the fights, especially in Syria. They were complicit in the works of ISIS. And let's not forget that ISIS was actually formed in that Petri dish that's called Abu Ghraib, the prison that was set up by the U.S. So the U.S. gave birth, or rather, when we want to talk about devils and
and demons, we would say the U.S. spawned ISIS, as it spawned every real terrorist group. And ISIS is a real, it's one of the most horrible terrorists. It's a truly terrorist group, unlike the liberation struggles that are that Palestinians and the Lebanese and the Yemenis are engaged in. Those are not the terrorists. The terrorist is the American government. The terrorist is the American military. The terrorist is the military industrial complex. The terrorist is the private and public prison industrial complex. That's where the terrorism happens, and they check off every single box in terms of terrorism. I'll end the show today with a report from Electronic Tifada with John Elmer, God bless him, who's been reporting about how when we say that Israel is losing the actual war and gaining their genocide, he's been reporting about what actually the losses that they're happening. And here he talks about what the Yemenis are doing and the gains that the Yemenis have made. Let's have a listen.
Tomorrow, I just wanted to bring this to people because this is the Houthis, Ansar Allah, the so-called Houthis, Ansar Allah and the Yemeni armed forces in Yemen yesterday launching a surface-to-air missile towards an American drone, an MQ-9 Reaper drone, which is like a, you know, like a $35 million, the flagship of the global drone products. It's the top of the line drone, and you can see it being hit there by what the Yemeni armed forces said was an indigenous surface to air missile and falling out of the sky. And we saw the Pentagon confirm that this was a U.S. drone knocked out of the sky, a $30 million drone knocked out of the sky by Yemeni resistance, which has continued. And the Yemeni resistance said yesterday when the U.S. vetoed the Security Council or vetoed the U.N. resolution that veto meant that the Red Sea veto would continue. And this is parts of the Reaper that the Yemenis pulled out of the sea, the Red Sea off Hodeidah. So I just wanted to bring that that last video in to show you that the resistance is continuing in Yemen. We don't see what it looks like when they fire the drones. Like yesterday, Ansar Allah fired a dozen drones at U.S. warships, had to fire them out of the air because they were on their way to hit the U.S. warships. And so we don't really get videos of that. So I just wanted to bring that Ansar Allah action so people could see that these American drones are susceptible to this kind of weapon. And of course, the Americans responded by randomly bombing what they believe are surface-to-air missile installations in Yemen. So the resistance continues on Israel's southern front in the Red Sea. They're American drones. This is the second Ansar Allah drone that has been downed. They downed one in November. And they managed to catch the video of it, which for information operations is pretty incredible to get that footage and to show us this footage. And I waited. I mean, Ali, we talked about this video and I waited for confirmation because you can't see what's on the videos, and we vet these videos as best as we can to make sure that we're showing authentic operations, and that we're not just showing these videos because the resistance released them. Just as a last point there, that's the end of the video showing the parts of the drone, which the Pentagon, presumably because people saw this, had to admit that their Reaper was downed.
John, if I can just say those Reaper drones are weapons of terror that U.S. warlords have been using to terrorize people across the region, particularly in Yemen, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, across the region. in Africa, in the Horn of Africa, across the world, really, for decades. So the ability of the resistance to shoot down these terror weapons is quite an extraordinary development, because the Ansarullah states, of course, we don't have a way to independently verify this, that this was a locally manufactured anti-aircraft missile. And if that's the case, that is extraordinary, because producing a Yassin is remarkable enough. But when you're firing a Yassin at a tank that is either stationary or moving relatively slowly, that's one thing. But to fire an anti-aircraft missile at a target that is very distant and moving very fast is certainly a in my view, a game-changing military development.
Yeah, it really is. But that's the thing. When in the West, when we call them the Houthis, it gives this impression that it's just this small group of people named after the leader of the group. But the Yemeni armed forces joined the Houthi movement. And so the Ansar Allah is a national army, because the national army of Yemen joined this fight. And so they have the resources of a national army, and we've seen them use those resources. That's why the Red Sea shipping, the Americans are saying, we haven't faced anything like this since World War II, when our actual warships are under attack, not tangentially, but actually under attack, hasn't happened since World War II. And they, the Ansar Allah movement and the Yemeni armed forces have access to anti-ship missiles, surface-to-air missiles, long-range missiles. We can ask the Saudis all about that. They know all about the missile capabilities of the Yemenis. And so that's something that we're seeing.
When I say that it's been used as a weapon of terror, I'm not being hyperbolic here, because I'm talking about all the attacks on wedding parties. I'm talking about the murder of an American citizen, a 16-year-old boy, Abdurrahman al-Awlaqi, who was targeted and killed by the Obama administration in Yemen with a drone. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. We're talking about war crimes around the world. And this shoot down comes in the context of the United States sending forces to the region to protect Israel as it exterminates Palestinians. So I just want to provide that context to my comment.
Yeah, they're armed drones. I think that's an important thing to say to people if they're not aware of that, that the Reaper is an armed drone. It's not simply surveillance. It's a hunter-killer drone that they use. Yeah, I mean, you said it as well as it could be said, that Yemenis were the first people to experience drone attacks. They were the people who experienced what an actual blockade does to a civilian population when they were starved for 5 years under a blockade. And they're turning that knowledge, that experience, around and saying, we refuse to allow the Palestinians to be blockaded. We refuse to do nothing like the world is doing about this genocide. And so I think that they should be saluted for that. Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that there's not another way of redressing the slow starvation of Palestinians that we're watching. It's just appalling.
I just want to back up the point that you made, John, about Yemen and the so-called Houthis, because this is a really important point that you made, that it, despite how the mainstream media in the West calling them the Iran-backed Houthis, it gives a really misleading impression. And this is not even a value judgment, right, of whether people support or don't support what the Yemeni armed forces are doing in their armed blockade of Israeli shipping in the Red Sea. It's nothing to do with that. It's just a factual matter of this is a government. You know, yes, there is another government based in the south, But the government based in the capital, Sana'a, has the armed forces, like you said, the armed forces defected to the Ansar Allah movement and, you know, now runs territory in which there's 80% of the population of Yemen. So by the mainstream media just saying, oh, it's the Houthis, it gives a really misleading impression as this is just sort of some armed rebel group that, you know, has a scrap of territory. This is the de facto government for most people in Yemen, for most of the vast majority of the population in Yemen, whether people in the West like that or not. That's just the factual matter.
And just to show again, because there is also an effort to diminish the significance of these things that we're seeing. I just put in the chat, Tamara, if you're able to put this story up on screen, that Egypt just announced that its fees that it earns for ships passing through the Suez Canal have declined by half because of the humanitarian intervention of Yemen to try to stop the genocide in Gaza. So this is an unintended, let's say, or unexpected consequence of U.S., British, and European support for the genocide, that this is a significant impact on global trade and shipping. And, you know, the European Union, well, first of all, let's say the Americans and the British already sent their aircraft carriers and their ships to the region in an attempt to stop this, and it had no impact. The Yemenis are continuing. And now the EU has announced that they're sending whatever boats they have, whatever ships they have. I don't think the European Union navies amount to very much. And let's see what luck they have. But the point here is that they are rushing, sending their navies in order to protect, I don't know, shipping of goods, consumer goods from China to Europe, but they have done nothing to break the 16-17 year Israeli naval blockade of Gaza, or even longer. They don't mind a blockade that starves civilians and cuts them off from the rest of planet Earth, but you know, stop a shipping container. If only Palestinian children in Gaza were shipping containers, the European Union would be much more upset. They might send their navies to intervene. So again, it's no longer a world where the United States and the Europeans can simply impose their will anymore. Even a country like Yemen, which has been subjected to bombardment, blockade, and true savagery for a decade, is able now to fight back, just as Palestinians in Gaza are still fighting almost 5 months after the U.S.-backed Israeli army, with all the weapons in the world, all the most sophisticated and powerful weapons, went at them with everything they have. So what I'm saying is that it's no longer a foregone conclusion what the outcome of engagements with a superpower will be.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And I mean, this is the Yemeni armed forces didn't operate in this way previously. This is a result of the outcome of the domestic situation in Yemen. So, but if this was 15 years ago and they did have that capability, maybe they would have started this blockade, trying to end the blockade before it was begun in Gaza. That has just become completely normalized. And all the things that we talk about in Gaza, the dismantling of all the civilian infrastructure, this has been going on since, you know, at least 2005. The hospitals, you know, if Dr. Tahir was talking to us 5 years ago, he would be talking about the impact of the blockade on the hospitals. So this dismantling has come on after The brutality of the blockade on Gaza that's been going on for half a generation now.
Thanks for watching this video. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel.
And that was the Electronic Intifada reporting on Yemeni resistance. We will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for the Shai Nana show on more from Gaza and about what's happening this week in terms of the events, first in the State of the Union address that will be disrupting, and also in terms of the issue of the March 10th Academy Awards, where the Israel plans to attack the Rafah in Gaza. Thank you for listening, and let's see you next week.
WPFW presents We Who Believe in Freedom, Women, Culture, and Resistance in celebration of International Women's Day 2024 from 5 a.m. until midnight, Friday, March 8th. While women must be lifted up every day, International Women's Day gives us a formal opportunity to celebrate how women show up in the world as culture keepers and warriors for truth and justice, and to be in solidarity with women around the globe working to ensure a brighter future for all of us. That's We Who Believe in Freedom, Women, Culture, and Resistance in celebration of International Women's Day this Friday, March 8th, 5 a.m. until midnight, here on your station for jazz and justice, WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm calling you, women. I'm calling you,
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. President Biden dominated the Super Tuesday Democratic primaries by sweeping every major contest. But yesterday's results across 15 states also showed a protest vote against Biden gaining traction. In Minnesota, almost 19% of Democratic voters, or about 46,000 people, marked their ballots uncommitted to show their opposition to Biden's support for Israel. Over 43,000 Democratic voters in Colorado voted uncommitted, as did 57,000 in Massachusetts and 88,000 in North Carolina. In Michigan's Democratic primary last week, more than 100,000 voters, or about 13% of the Democratic electorate, cast their ballots as uncommitted. The movement was organized by various politicians and community organizers of Arab and Muslim descent, and was intended as an act of electoral protest against Biden's support for Israel's invasion of Gaza. Yesterday, a caucus in the territory of American Samoa was won by a little-known candidate who earned 51 votes to Biden's 40. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley announced today that she is exiting the GOP presidential race, leaving former President Trump as the party's presumptive nominee. Haley's comments come after Trump swept the majority of Super Tuesday contests, only losing in Vermont. Speaking to a crowd of supporters in Charleston, South Carolina this morning, Haley thanked those who backed her bid for the White House, but she did not endorse Trump. She said, quote, "It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him, and I hope he does that," end quote. In local news, the D.C. Council yesterday approved a massive public safety bill intended to crack down on a crime spike in the district last year. The bill, called the Secure D.C. Omnibus Amendment Act, includes a range of measures, including harsher punishments for gun possession and retail theft, temporary drug-free zones, and loosened restrictions on police activity. The bill would also empower judges to extend pretrial detention for adults and some juveniles charged with violent offenses. Some bill provisions were particularly controversial, including a measure attempting to decrease the felony theft threshold from $1,000 to $500. That measure was amended prior to passage. The bill passed as Congress has sought ways to interfere in the local D.C. criminal justice system. New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced today the deployment of National Guard troops and state troopers to the New York City subway system to help search bags for weapons amid concerns about crimes on city trains. Hochul said the deployment would include 750 National Guard members and 250 state troopers. NYPD cops already conduct random bag checks at subway entrances, though people are free to refuse and leave the station. Hochul's announcement came as part of a broader plan meant to tackle crime on the subway, including a proposed state law that would ban train travel for people convicted of assault on a subway passenger. Crimes, on average, are down across New York City since the COVID-19 pandemic.